do something a little bit different today. He's in town. He was passing, so we grabbed him. Chris Southworth is the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce, and he joins me live in the studio. Chris, thank you. Tell us briefly, if you would, what the International Chamber of Commerce does and how it does it.
We're the largest world business organization. We represent 45 million companies and 1 billion employees in over 100 countries. And our central role is to provide a voice for business at intergovernmental level. So my job is to represent UK industry at the World Trade Organization, UN and G20.
We've heard a little bit about the World Trade Organization lately. We know what the UN and the G20 are, but we'll probably concern ourselves initially with the former. There was an interesting intervention from the Director General of the World Trade Organization last week that went largely unremarked by the Brexit supporting media. He made it pretty clear that the so-called Article 24 escape route that has been espoused and promoted by the likes of Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg is nothing of the sort. Who understands the World Trade Organization better, the Director General or Marc Francois?
It's definitely Roberto Azevedo. I mean, the Article 24 issue is a red herring. So I would suggest, you know, we focus on the facts, really. But I mean, ultimately, Article 24 is there for two countries who have already agreed that they will enter a trade deal. And that provides a transitionary platform. But actually, the way that it's been presented in the UK really sort of gives the impression, actually, that we would be trading on single market customs union rules when we're actually outside Europe, which is not going to happen.
For 10 years, according to Jacob.
Yeah. And it's also missing a key step that we actually have to leave the EU first, trade on the WTO rules, and then get into, if we go into no deal, that is, and then get into a negotiation around what the future partnership is.
You say if we go to no deal, and I appreciate that your role would preclude you from political positioning, but it's a very tiny if now, isn't it, and a rather larger when.
Yeah, it's looking that way, and people are obviously incredibly concerned overseas that that's the direction of travel.
How, and again, this may fall under the purview of your personal views, in which case feel free not to answer it, but how do people like you compute what's happened in our country over the last 3 years? I mean, forgive me, your job description used to be quite dull. It didn't used to be, you know, it didn't used to be something that the rest of us concerned ourselves with. I perhaps wrongly, perhaps complacently, I'm happy to leave the heavy lifting to people like you or the Director General of the World Trade Organization. You've seen the pitch on which you've played your life, your career, invaded by people who don't seem to understand even the most basic rules. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think it's true that, you know, there's an awful lot of commentary around trade in general, actually, but particularly around the WTO, by people who frankly haven't even been to Geneva, never mind the WTO. You know, it's a very technical organisation, it's a technical business, and there's an awful lot of misinformation out there. And so it's very frustrating because, you know, we, like all the other business organisations, actually, have been very consistent in the message we're giving, but then getting swiped aside by really an ideological argument about being outside Europe. So from a trade point of view, it just doesn't make any sense at all. So that, you know, our international audience are flabbergasted by what we're doing, particularly as it's a voluntary decision as well. Why would you leave you know, the premiership of trade, which is undoubtedly the single market, to then trade on a less preferential set of terms in what would be a sort of first division? It doesn't make any sense.
I think that was Pascal Lamy's analogy, wasn't it, as well, the self-imposed relegation from Division 1 to Division 3. When do we begin to feel the ramifications of being in Division 3? How quickly after November the 1st could that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, that. I mean, I think, you know, you've got to remember that Brexit's only the beginning of a very long road. You know, we need to, first of all, leave Europe, Brexit peace, then negotiate a deal with Europe, and then start to negotiate deals with 120 countries to get up to the same level we currently are. No one has ever done that in history, certainly not at the scale and pace that we're proposing to do it. And then the average time to negotiate a trade deal is 5 to 7 years. And in the extreme cases, like the EU-Mercosur deal, which has just been agreed, is 20 years. Now, I'm not suggesting it's going to take 20 years per deal, but it just gives a sense of the task ahead. And that means, you know, decades probably of disruption and uncertainty. Nobody, by the way, trades on WTO rules.
There was a rumour at one point that Mauritania did, but I gather they've now signed a trade deal or two.
Yeah, no, we were looking into Mauritania. I think it was us that said that, or me actually. They also have a bilateral arrangements with their neighbours, but you know, every country trades ultimately with their neighbours first. And the WTO, what they call the WTO rules, are really there as a backstop. They're there as a safety net. But actually, in reality, every country, you know, has much more sophisticated trade relationships. But if the UK crash out of the EU, we really will drop down to that safety net. And that's unheard of for a G20, never mind a G7 country.
Is there anywhere, I mean, even outside the G20 and the G7, is there anywhere we can look to for I mean, whether it be positive or negative, the view, but it would be at least a precedent, something that might give us a flavour of the terms and conditions under which we'll be operating internationally?
Not to my knowledge. You probably have to look at sort of Venezuela or Syria or somewhere like that, you know, not to my knowledge.
And Venezuela is only temporarily excluded from Mercosur, isn't it? So,
yeah,
so they could
yeah.
actually be better off than us if they get their house in order.
I mean, possibly. I mean, you know, we should couch that. You know, I don't want to be sort of badged as Project Fear, but, you know, we have to be realistic and we have to get real a little bit, to be honest. It's that stage in the game. Is that, you know, that most countries don't want disruption and
yes.
most countries want continuity with the UK. It's an important market and an awful lot to offer two ways, actually. But that doesn't preclude the fact that there need to be negotiations and they will take a long time to get back to where we currently stand today.
So what's the best case scenario if no deal goes ahead come November the 1st?
Well, I mean, you know, the UK will continue. It's a very resilient economy,
yeah.
very innovative.
It may well shrink, according to the Office of Budget Responsibility, but nobody's suggesting it will disappear.
No, absolutely, and it'd be wrong to suggest that it would. You know, many of the services industries, don't forget, Brexit's in a way kind of happened for the financial services, insurance, pharma. They've all shifted licenses, you know, finance assets over to Europe anyway.
Open new funds in Dublin.
Absolutely. But, the, you know, the people we really need to care about here are small companies in the regions. They're the ones who are going to get hit the hardest in the manufacturing supply chains. That's where the tariffs
How are they going to be hit? I suspect that we might need... stuff that you consider to be obvious and simplistic might come as something as a surprise, even a shock to some of my listeners. So how, for example, is somebody currently sending a proportion of their goods to European Union countries or, of course, and this is a key point that I do think people don't understand, or to one of those 120 countries with whom we have trade agreements as a result of Europe? I mean, there'll be varying degrees of regulation, won't there? But anybody in business in Britain with customers overseas whose country has a relationship with the European Union or is in the European Union, how will they be affected?
Well, the first thing will happen will be hard borders, and that means there'll be tariffs and a whole bunch of paperwork, customs, export declarations, rules of origin, all of that sort of paperwork.
All of which currently is a relatively straightforward process.
Well, you know, you have to remember most companies are trading into Europe, especially SMEs, and so they don't have to deal with any of that. And probably, you know... anyone under the age of 50 who's running a company, which is quite a lion's share of the management structure, probably never dealt with any of this stuff before. So there's a whole exercise to upskill everybody as to what this paperwork is. So I think, you know, and then in certain sectors are likely to get hit harder than others. The auto sector, for sure. Agriculture, for sure. Where the tariffs, food and drink, you know, who all operate on very, very efficient supply chains, you know, minutes across borders, very little paperwork, if any. So the moment you start to add delays or add bureaucracy into the system, then immediately that means costs.
So presumably you were even more gobsmacked than I was when Jeremy Hunt stood up the other day and talked about a factory near Kidderminster with a 4% margin on its production, facing tariffs, he thought, of around 10%. Some experts suggest they could be higher. That would put them out of business almost immediately, certainly by Christmas. And he talked about having to preside over 260 job losses, plus, of course, the attendant businesses servicing that workforce and that factory in Cookley. He talked about doing it with a heavy heart. I mean, I can't, as a journalist, I can't believe I'm asking you this question. But Jeremy Hunt is right, isn't he?
Yeah, it's extraordinary that we're here having this conversation.
It is a little bit surreal, isn't it?
First and foremost, I think, you know, we need to almost back up a bit and just remind ourselves we're talking about people's livelihoods,
mm-hmm.
people's jobs, people's families, communities. A lot of these factories are actually in fairly vulnerable areas that are not easy to replace.
Well, the Black Country, where we're referring to, has already seen its industrial heartland ripped out once, and now it's facing the whatever phoenixes grew from those ashes could be similarly extinct.
Yeah, and by the way, it's the same those same areas that were ripped out in the 80s that are still vulnerable today. In other words, our transition from what was a specific type of manufacturing to a different type of industry hasn't been very successful. So the suggestion and they that it will be high... successful the next time, our track record is not particularly good in the UK on that front.
And so when Patrick Minford talks about, the pocket economist of the European Research Group talks about the automotive industry or the agricultural industry essentially going the way of the coal mines, he slightly overlooks, perhaps deliberately, perhaps not deliberately, the fact that most of those communities that were decimated by the closure of steel and coal facilities have never fully recovered. And then perversely, or not perversely, when you look at some of the propaganda that was inflicted upon them, they have a very high leave voting record. So these people have voted to leave because they're unsatisfied with their lives, often justifiably so, but they've voted, unless something astonishing and utterly unpredicted happens, to make their already unhappy existences measurably worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's frustrating. I mean, I come from the regions myself. I mean, I understand the arguments have been there for a long time.
I come from Kidderminster.
I come from the north. And, you know, the frustrations are real, and they've been bubbling away for well over 40 years. But the policies to solve those issues, need to be put in place in order to then actually address them. Leaving Europe will probably exacerbate the issues. They're suffering from a long-term underinvestment in infrastructure, particularly in schools and roads and transport and airports and so on. And of course, you know, we're paying the price for that in the UK. We haven't had as good a regional economic strategy and implementation as other countries around Northern Europe, particularly.
Richard Tice is a businessman and a member of the Brexit, quotes, party, end quotes. I think he's the chairman. He said, our government hasn't yet asked for an Article 24 agreement under the WTO, whereby you'd basically have a two-year standstill. It's extraordinary that they didn't ask for that. Will you stay with us for a little longer, Chris? Is that okay? We'll take you on to half past if we may. I don't need any calls on this, but if you think there's a question that Chris Salford might be able to answer for you, feel free to get involved. You know the number, 03456060973. But we're just simply in the business of putting fact-based evidence out there this morning. I'm not up for a scrap yet, not until we've waved goodbye to Chris. So if there's something you want to know, even perhaps something he might be able to help you with, because, you know, it's just 3 months away, give or take, a couple of weeks. It's 10:18.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
22 minutes after 10 is the time. Chris Southworth is the Secretary General at the International Chamber of Commerce UK, a trade body that internationally, I wrote the number down actually, Chris, because I thought I might forget it, that represents 45 million companies on the world stage, with particular reference to intergovernmental activity and the World Trade Organization, the United Nations and the G20. Just to clarify, because a lot of people are marching around the place saying things like this, Richard Tice, the Brexit Party chairman, said, our government hasn't yet asked for an Article 24 agreement under the WTO, whereby you'd basically have a two-year standstill. It's extraordinary that they didn't ask for that. Do you understand what he's saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but ultimately, to have any type of agreement like that, you need to agree that with your partners. And in that case, that's the EU, and that's not on the table. So,
which they've made repeatedly and crystal clear.
Absolutely. But if the EU and the UK go into the WTO and say, OK, this is what we want, then I'm sure the WTO would listen to that. But you can't do that on your own. It's a negotiation. It's a deal.
In fact, it's entirely in the gift of the EU, because if we've already said, if people like Tice have already said, this is what we want, the decision is taken by the remaining European Union members.
Yeah, and it also misses the point once you leave the EU, if that's actually what's being asked, you're still trading on the same terms. And in other words, you've left, but you haven't left. And that would be odd for the EU to agree to something like that.
But otherwise, there's no point being in the EU.
or leaving it.
what... What is the WTO terms then? And to talk us through what this actually means.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, the WTO, you know, when you're operating in the EU, you're dealing with 27 countries, you're operating as one block. The EU itself is one of the three major power players in the trading world, with the US and China obviously being the other two. But you're ultimately operating in a very aligned block. You have common positions and so on, and common trading rules. When you come out of the EU, you're moving into an institution, the World Trade Organization, where you're dealing with 150 countries. You're operating on your own. You're not in a block. You need to build alliances within that to get stuff done. And you have lots of differing interests. In other words, it's a much, much more complicated animal. And so the idea of leaving and then operating on WTO rules, which, as I said earlier, is the sort of very basic safety net that no country really operates on, you've got to be incredibly sophisticated and understand what your abilities are within that institution to be really effective in it.
And what does favoured nation mean? I hear that phrase quite a lot.
Well, I mean, most favoured nation status is really about establishing a common level playing field for everyone. So if you agree something with one country, then that applies to all countries. So it's a principle of fairness. It's a slightly technical term, but ultimately it's about being fair, that you can't have, you know, a series of trading terms with one country and then have a different set of terms with another WTO member. You have to apply it across the board.
So trade agreements are a way out of most favoured nation status issues. Because if you've got a free trade agreement, then only the signatories to that operate under its terms. Other countries can't sell into that market on the same terms and conditions?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because at the moment, the WTO historically obviously is focused on what we call multilateral deals.
Yes.
One set of rules for everybody, and that deals with the most favoured nation status issue. At the moment, there's four work streams on a plurilateral basis, which means it's sort of 77 countries of the 150. And then there's a really interesting question that if those 77 countries agree, for instance, they're negotiating on digital trade right now, a deal on digital trade, actually under WTO rules, everybody benefits, whether you're in the negotiating group or not. But you can supplement that with your own preferential terms on a bilateral basis. So if you look at a country like Singapore, both Singapore and the UK support the negotiations on digital trade, but the negotiations are likely to come forward with a sort of a common position which is below the standards that Singapore and the UK would want to trade. And so they'll supplement that with a more sophisticated relationship on a bilateral basis.
So it's the point below which you cannot go, essentially.
Yeah,
and everybody would rather be above that point, but it's an internationally agreed... See, this is part of the problem, actually, just to veer off piece briefly. This is complicated and occasionally quite dense stuff. I mean, you're explaining it more clearly than anyone else I've encountered. But on the other side of the table, you just have some Herbert shouting, take back control or make America great again or down with the EU. But there's no easily administered pill on your side of the argument to bring home to people just how complicated the reality is and how dangerous it is to pretend otherwise. That must be very frustrating.
Yeah, something we're talking a lot about at the moment within the business community is the need for diplomacy, both political diplomacy, but also business diplomacy. You know, talking in those kind of terms, it just comes across really poorly.
Yes.
In an organization that is political, and you have to really respect the relationships, because obviously if you want to do deals or you want to get things done, it's all about the relationships you have with those countries. So if you go charging around making accusations or strong statements, clearly that offends people.
Defences
go up and it becomes much harder to do things.
Can you see when reality does bite, the World Trade Organization becoming the next scapegoat in the way that these people have falsely blamed Brussels or falsely blamed the European Union for X, Y, and Z? And, you know, who elected the Director General of the World Trade Organization, for example? I could imagine that being a Daily Express headline. Rather than blame themselves for having led Britain down this path, they'll try and blame it on unelected bureaucrats at the World Trade Organization.
Yeah, there's always an element of that, and you can hear pockets of that conversation. The same applies to the UN as well. But I think we need to recognise the achievements of these organisations. It's very difficult to get the world to agree on anything. You know, there's a terrific diversity, a lot of different needs, all of which need to be respected. But the WTO ultimately has been pivotal in reducing poverty by 40% and quadrupling global GDP.
But the European Union has been pivotal in increasing prosperity exponentially and safeguarding peace across the whole of continental Europe. So these little observations don't necessarily butter any parsnips, is it?
No, but you know, it is important to keep reminding everyone of the benefits that they provide. And also, you know, okay, you attack the WTO, and then, okay, let's just assume that you remove the WTO. What are you going to replace it with?
You know, well, there's a question.
It would be like, you know, removing all the road rules in London and then expecting everyone to drive in an orderly fashion.
Don't ring me to offer your support for the idea of removing all the road rules in London and having a kind of anarchist free-for-all on the streets of the city.
But that's an analogy the WTO use. Yes. You know, ultimately, it's there to provide rules so that we can all have an orderly set of relationships.
It's a very pet subject, this, because I'm a little bit more fascinated by words than is normal. If we changed regulations and called them protections, the whole debate would change. I think if people feel that if I tell them that there are regulations being put in place, they can be persuaded to feel aggrieved by that or squeezed by that. If you call them protections, which is, of course, what they are, and it's why the analogy of road rules, road protections work so well, then it just feels very, very differently in the ear.
Yeah, I mean, good regulation. I mean, ultimately, it's about good regulation, right? I mean, good regulation is there to enable us to live and do business in a safe way. In a good way. Yeah. That's good regulation. And there are lots of good examples, whether it's wearing seatbelts in cars or not using mobile phones in cars, whatever that might
be. Crash helmets.
And there are
construction
always,
site absolutely. Protections,
and
high visibility
examples
jackets.
Of bad regulation, but those are in a tiny minority. You know, and that applies the same in the WTO. The rules in the WTO are there to help protect everyone in the world, not just the UK.
What time's your next appointment, Chris Southworth?
10, I'm going to leave at 10 well soon, 11 o'clock.
Can we have you for 15 more minutes?
Sure.
We'll book you a car.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Chris Southworth is the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce UK. I've got lots of calls waiting, but what I'll do, rather than put people through, I'll do it myself from the calls on the board, and that'll help us on the time front. So rest assured, some of these questions are actually better than the ones I've managed to come up with, so we will hit them in just a moment after Simon Conway brings you the very latest headlines.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Right, let's try and rattle through a few of your questions for Chris Southworth, Secretary General at the International Chamber of Commerce. I'll throw in one first. I think it's important. A couple of people have asked it. America, this suggestion now that we will be able to sign some preferential or advantageous deal with them, leaving aside the obvious vulnerability that Britain will be subject to and the fact that America will be able to dictate terms and conditions, even if we pretended that was a good idea, how easy, how plausible is some sort of trade deal with them?
Well, there's a good reason why we don't have a trade deal with the US is because we have quite dramatic differences of opinion. Our consumers and citizens have differences of opinion on things like food standards. If you think about chlorinated chicken or public services, think NHS. Both of those issues sunk the transatlantic trade investment partnership deal after 5 to 7 years of negotiation. You know, the strength of feeling and the difference is very apparent and more than enough to kill a deal. So I think, you know, it sounds great. Come out of Europe, go and do a deal with the US. In reality, that is highly unlikely because it is very complicated. What probably better is to focus in on regulatory alignment. You know, most of the trade between us and the US is services-based. Mm. And so actually much of a trade deal, tariffs and that kind of thing, aren't really the issue. We'd be better off focusing on how you harmonize the regulatory frameworks between the two countries. But that's not a trade deal. That's just an ongoing kind of dialogue between the two countries.
And it would involve,
probably deliver more benefit.
But it would be dilution on our side of the Atlantic, wouldn't it? As opposed to them stepping up to our standards.
No, not necessarily. I mean, but you need to just harmonize the two sets of regulations whether on both sides.
Right.
But that's not a trade deal.
Oh, I see.
And that would probably be a better alternative than talking up a trade deal, which is going to be tough at best, but probably quite unlikely in the short term.
And you speak solely on the trade terms, not the politics, because, of course, the likelihood of getting anything through Congress, which throws Ireland under a bus, is pretty much close to non-existent for a whole heap of different reasons. Right. Paul in Northwood, why is it? Why does it appear to be so complicated to negotiate a new trade deal?
Well, you know, a trade deal is there for good reasons. You know, it's there to, one, promote national interests. And so, of course, two countries have two different sets of interests. But it's also there to protect citizens. It's there to protect businesses. And it's there to protect your economy at the end of the day. So, you know, you've got to negotiate, and they're fiercely complicated. They can be incredibly detailed, all the way down to fish to nuts and bolts and all sorts of things. But obviously what you don't want to do is put your own economy...
So the short answer is, because there's so much in it, Paul, it has to specify for every single thing that could or is being traded.
Absolutely. Right. And obviously you care about your representative communities, and you've got to look after those on both sides. So you're negotiating what you can do, but also trying to protect what you don't want to hurt.
And in fact, you could point out that a small number of farmers in the Wallonia region of Belgium put quite a big hole in the road for the Canada trade deal, because even their specific concerns had to be accommodated. So even when you think you're finished, I think that's a good answer. Just scale the sheer number of stuff, amount of stuff that has to go into it. James and Eccles, I like this question, James, and I admire honesty, because there's an awful lot of people, probably even at cabinet level, that can't answer this, but would never be prepared to admit it publicly. What is a tariff? Does it go into the country's economy, and will reducing them to zero affect government incomes?
Well, a tariff is there effectively. It's a cost. It's a fee that you pay, and it's there really to protect your respective industries. And so they're there in place. Governments put them in place or negotiate the tariffs to try and make sure that you don't flood your own economies with, say, cheap imports. So if there's been talk about removing all the tariffs. If you removed all the tariffs, ultimately you're opening up your borders and your economy to every import everywhere in the world. Go back to that, MFN principle at the WTO. You can't open up your tariffs to one, drop your tariffs to one country. You have to do it for everybody. And that means you'd be flooded with all sorts of food and goods and services.
So this is what allows people like Jacob Rees-Mogg to talk about cheap shoes. On one level, he's correct. We will have access to cheap shoes, but we won't know whether they've been made in sweatshops, and we'll be waving goodbye to what remains of any British competitors in these fields within weeks.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, farming's a good example of this. UK farming's protected for a good reason, because we care about the land and we care about who looks after the land. But if you opened up and removed all the tariffs, then you'd be opening up your market to sheep or beef coming in from all over the world, which is produced, by the way, at a much lesser cost.
But that because they use hormones and antibiotics.
Absolutely.
And they have less
human
farming standards,
scale,
veterinarian regulations, yep. All of these things.
Yeah, and that would put a lot of farmers out of business almost overnight.
And that comes back to Paul's question about why does it take so long? Because all of this stuff has to be in it. Mm. Thank you, James. What about the bit about where the tariffs go? The money, who gets, you put a tariff on something, 10% on bringing in New Zealand lamb or actually something French would be a better example. Where does that money go?
Well, it goes into the respective economies.
Meaning?
Yeah, if you've got tariffs between two countries, then obviously you're generating revenue on those tariffs, that will just go into the economy.
So that's a silver lining of sorts or not?
Money into
the treasury, effectively.
To be honest, in the bigger scheme of things, you'll remember the UK is 80% services, so yeah. Tariffs actually aren't really the big issue at all. And globally speaking, the WTO has done a great job. One of the successes of the WTO is actually to remove most tariffs. So they're not the bigger issue. The trouble is that where they are applicable are in industries that really do matter, like agriculture or auto. And that means
some of our biggest employers.
Absolutely. And, you've only got to increase tariffs 1, 2, 3, 4% to start to make companies either uncompetitive or unviable.
Which brings us back to Jeremy Hunt and the factory in Kidderminster. Darren in Clapham wants to know, how long will the disruption last? Do we have any statistics explaining how long businesses might be able to weather the storm that, of course, Brexiters like to call short-term disruption, while lying about the fact that people knew that that was on the horizon?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, it certainly will be uncertain until there's an EU deal on the table, as in a future deal. So we've got to get out of Europe first, if that's the way we're going, and then get a new deal. And once we get the new deal, that will provide certainty to everyone trading into Europe, which is the lion's share of the economy. But actually, all the other countries who will be doing deals with us, particularly the big ones like Japan and India and so on, are all looking to see what the deal will be with Europe before they'll do a deal with us. And the Japanese have been very open about that.
They have. It's so, underreported here, perhaps, because it's not pretty reading, is it?
Not particularly. And then if you look at, in terms of, doing the 120 deals that we have to do, it's hard to see that happening within the next 20 years. I mean, it'll take a long
20
time.
20 years?
I would have thought so. I mean, you just can't negotiate. Where's the capacity, the bandwidth?
So the other
skills,
bit, Darren's question is how many businesses would be able to survive that 20-year window? And the answer is in the sectors that you've already specified, not many.
Well, yeah, well, you just have to adapt. You have to adapt to the environment. It depends on what markets you're trading in, of course. You know, the government rightly will focus on the ones that, that matter the most economically. But it depends. If you're trading into a market that's not necessarily on the priority list, then you're going to have to wait longer.
Who's going to do well out of this?
Well, I mean, everybody loses in a hard deal Brexit. And, that you know, everybody said that.
But somebody must make a few quid out of it. Someone must have bet on black, as it were.
Well, if they do, and I'm sure there are always winners and losers, yes. The winners, you know, are outnumbered by the people who lose. Economies lose, Europe loses, we lose, our trading partners lose. We all lose because the relationship between the UK and Europe is so important. It's huge. In terms of not only at a regional level, but also to the global economy, it's important.
Of course. And the trade agreement you mentioned with that slightly scary 20-year sell-by date, that the EU have been pretty consistent and clear that they won't even begin talking about that until we've signed off on citizens' rights, Northern Ireland, and the divorce bill. In your contacts and connections and conversations, is there any glimmer of hope that the EU might abandon the position that it's sustained pretty much consistently since June 2016?
Well, I'm not suggesting that an EU deal would take 20 years. Obviously,
to replace all 120.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I think it's hard to see the EU changing position. They've been very consistent in their position.
What if we just believe more?
The belief isn't what gets deals done. I mean, it's practical.
Are you sure? Possibly you need to go to the Ian Duncan Smith School of Negotiation. Belief apparently can break all sorts of eggs. And finally, let me choose a nice one. Actually, just touches on what you just said. Jack in Dogden says, we don't hear much about how the EU will suffer. I'm sure the question isn't intended to suggest that we want to hear a lot about the EU suffering, but I know, because I'm an anorak now on this subject, that their preparedness notices have been in place for ages. I know, for example, in the Hook of Holland, whence a huge amount of our fresh vegetables and fresh fruit comes from, I didn't even know that, they've already made immense changes. The most frightening thing about this suggestion that we need to threaten them with no deal, if I've understood things correctly, is that they're a hell of a lot more prepared for no deal than we are.
They're more prepared, but their small companies, SMEs, are also not as prepared as they want them to be, that's for sure. But, you know, Europe will be hurt, and certain economies like the Netherlands actually will get hit harder, because that's where there's a lot of our trade. Ireland will get hit hard too. But, you know, this goes down to the kind of root of the issue, is understanding that the UK-EU relationship is not as important as the EU project. And so for the EU, whatever the cost, it's not as big as the cost of the disintegration of Europe. So it's from a political point of view and an economic point of view, the effort will go into protecting the EU.
They will take that
first, at the cost of losing, you know, the UK, although nobody wants the UK to leave. You know,
again, another message that perhaps hasn't reached these shores as loudly as it should have. And finally, you've seen that forecast from the Office of Budget Responsibility. Real GDP could fall by 2%. Of course, if it falls by 1.5, that's not good news or proof that the OBR is unreliable. By the end of 2020, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, is that as, and of course, that would see Britain's economy pushed into a recession. Is that as bad as it gets? Do you recognise this analysis?
Yeah, no, I mean, the WTO put a figure on something like 8%, you know, over the course of time. It depends. I mean, you know, you can talk figures like these and all day long. I mean, ultimately, we've said, as the business community actually have all said, that, you know, there will be a hit to the economy. It's just a question of how big and how long will that hit be before the UK recover. But there definitely will be a GDP hit for sure.
I'd like to say it's been a pleasure. I mean, in some ways it has. I'm always, of course, keen to learn, but I'm not going to pretend that these are happy lessons to learn. Chris Stafford, thank you for your efforts, your expertise, and your time this morning. We should do this again.
Absolutely.
Better late than never.
My pleasure.